So I have two older brothers, and my older brother was about to start taking his confirmation classes. So he had him at about 13, 14, the typical age. And me being 3 years younger, or 10 years old, a little bit younger than most people who enter confirmation. But my parents' attitude was kind of like, well, do we really want to have to come and bring him here for like 10 weeks again, 3 to 4 years from now? So I kind of got a 2-for-1 deal. So again, it wasn't, the focus wasn't, you know, the actual spiritual context, but the inconvenience of me maybe having to go through this all over again 3 years later. So again, from that point forward, I'd say as I got older, we started going to church less and less. And by the time I reached junior high, we were probably not really going all together. And up to this point, I describe my spiritual life as passive. It's not a knock. Again, I don't do this to knock my parents or how I was raised in any way. It's just that's how spirituality was defined in our house. And I wouldn't really say it had been at the forefront of my mind. And I would have been given an introductory understanding of Christianity, but the seed of spirituality is planted. And again, although I describe it as not passive at the forefront, I would say there was still a confidence in what I had been given. Not the arrogant, like, I'm right kind of confidence, but the, you know, this is how I've been raised, this is what I was taught kind of confidence. I went to church because my parents took me, and they knew it was right. There I was taught how God works, and as a child, there was no reason to doubt or challenge it. Nor really had there been any event in my life that caused me to challenge it or conflict it, really, with what I had been taught. I would describe it as an inherited, innocent kind of confidence or certainty. And again, this wouldn't be unique to spiritual beliefs. I think most children believe everything their parents tell them, believe that they're right. I mean, parents know everything. They knew it all. Everybody's parents had it all figured out, just like anyone else. And so there's really no need to question. And again, I got to say, being on the other side of it, it's one of the perks of being an adult, to finally have all the answers and have everything figured out. So for all intents and purposes, my spiritual life paused, I'd say, you know, until about midway through grade 11 when I got a new girlfriend. Now, I feel like there's a joke here about starting to date somebody and it being a religious experience, so I'll kind of leave that one there. But in all seriousness, at this point, Kat and I started dating. And this is kind of where it becomes a bit less of just a me, but a bit of a we story. So Kat's religious upbringing was different than mine. Where mine was casual, hers was all-encompassing. Church wasn't just Sunday morning. It was Sunday evening, Wednesday evening Bible study, Friday night youth, daily devotionals. Kat was raised in United Pentecostal Church, which was a very strict evangelical denomination with many rules and standards to abide by. And when we started dating, she was still going to this church. So, no, we were in the puppy dog stage, so of course my interests were her interests. Or flip that. And at any rate, so I started attending with her. And that's where I say I went from like an intro to Christianity to like a master's in evangelical Christianity. All of a sudden, religion was everything. You know, I was going 4 times a week as well. And shortly after my 18th birthday, I was baptized again. And what I had learned was the exact right way. Not as a child, full immersion, and in the name of Jesus, not Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Specifically. So there's, you know, a very specific set of ways for it to be done. You know, we were helping with youth group, volunteering in Sunday school, and the majority of our social activities were with church friends. And, you know, this belief system kind of picked up nicely from where the last one had kind of dropped off. And brought me something nice as a top-up. It's the certainty I'd had from the childhood one. You know, that innocent and inherited confidence I'd mentioned earlier was beginning to wane. And then this came back and filled that tank way back up. It had all the answers. I could be confident in my position here and in the next life because I'd found the one true path. And as a young adult, I had it all figured out. Again, it's not a unique experience that most teenagers and young adults, I think most teenagers think they have it all figured out until maybe retrospect teaches them otherwise. You know, outside the textbooks I was studying for university, I read the Bible, devotionals, and writings by Christian authors. I listened to mainly worship music or music by Christian artists. I didn't really bother to take in anything that I didn't believe with because why bother? I had it all sorted. Or maybe more accurately, I didn't want the devil to tempt me with false doctrines. A quick pause on that. And, in retrospect, it's not lost on me the irony of this thinking. You know, I'm so steadfast, so certain in my beliefs that I don't want to read anything that contradicts it in case it destroys my beliefs. So which one is it? Is your faith so strong or yet so easily shaken? I can remember intense debates about the age of the earth, the validity of the Bible, and how it was the truth. You can't take bits and pieces, I'd say. Of course I believe it all. If I didn't, it'd be ignoring the parts that said, it's true, non-negotiable, and it all has to be believed. It was all so easy. Everything was wrapped in a nice little bow, or so it seemed. So as I mentioned earlier, this might contradict with the, I thought this was the I need evidence, gotta dig deeper kind of guy. But for some reason up to this point in my story, that part of me wasn't really allowed into that part of my life. All other parts of my life were open, but not this. Or maybe more accurately, when that question part of me did present itself in my spiritual life, it was all but routinely shut down by the environment that didn't allow for doubt or question. So as I mentioned, you know, things were kind of humming along nicely, but this all changed on September 1st, 2005, when Kathleen's mother passed away from cancer at the age of 48. Now, I want to be sensitive to the people here and others who this is more their story than mine. So I'm not going to share, you know, too many details because they're not mine to share. But I can say that it was a hard loss, which is true for anybody that loses somebody they love and care for. But when you wrap it up in a system that allows for a God that can miraculously cure you in an instant and doesn't today, it can be devastating. So the repercussions for my spirituality weren't immediate from this. But it did plant a seed that something didn't reconcile. So everything wasn't quite as tidy as it once had been. And now the part of me that wanted to dig deeper was now sort of let loose on this part of my life. Things that I'd previously held as sacred or unchanging began to fall apart upon further inspection. The analytical side of me began to notice that things didn't add up and the cognitive dissonance was growing. Why? Why would an all-loving being who loves you like a parent loves a child want to send you to an afterlife where you're going to suffer for all eternity? Why does an all-powerful being allow suffering and pain? Or I'm sure thankful that I was raised in the country and happened to win the lottery in beliefs and I was lucky to get to know the one truth. Again, I know these questions aren't particularly unique, or even ones that I hadn't been faced with previously. It's just, I was actually now taking them to heart. And those quippy Bible verses that you could snap back to respond suddenly rang hollow. Verses like Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. Verses like this were used as a release valve or a cop-out to help keep everything tidy. You know, you'd be preached and taught God is A, B, and C. Except when he wasn't, and then a verse like this would say, well, we don't know everything. So I can remember unironically quoting this and then proceeding to talk about with certainty what God was thinking or doing. And somehow while in the system, it seemed to reconcile, but it was clear now that it didn't. Again, this can sound like a quick process, but honestly, it took years. Kat and I continued to attend that same church for 9 more years. And it was a slow fade, kept going week after week, just going through the motions. And honestly, it was scary. We'd both been steeped in this world, and her for 15 years longer than I, where everything was framed as all or nothing. Where ideas like eternal damnation were used to keep you in line and cause you to fear uncertainty and knowing. Bible verses were used as weapons to keep you on the straight and narrow. Verses like Revelation 3, 15, 16. I know your deeds, and you're neither hot nor cold. I wish you were one or the other. Because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. So if I began to take apart my faith and strip away parts, would there be anything left? Would my soul be okay? Would I still be saved? Could I call myself a Christian? Does it matter? And I think this fear stopped us from truly talking about it for a long time. We were both having these thoughts, but somewhat left to struggle with them on our own. And neither of us probably wanted to go there in fear that the other wasn't feeling the same way. I do remember one galvanizing moment was a particular sermon in our previous church we were all in attendance for. And the gist of the message was something along the lines of, you know, we all have different skills and gifts and abilities that we can bring to God and serve God. Who squeezes the toothpaste from the middle? And who from the bottom? Who likes salty? Who likes sweets? Wouldn't it be boring if we were all the same? And this was all well and good, except one important caveat, which was okay to be special within their constraints. So it's okay to be different, but not if you're Muslim. Not if you're an atheist, or even one of those other Christian denominations that didn't know the real truth that we did. And again, it's not that these ideas weren't present all along. Of course, if I believed I was saved or had some sort of, you know, special place because of what I did believe, it meant that others weren't. But the thing was, it was often usually implied. It was never directly they're wrong. It was, well, you, maybe you're wrong, but you'll get better, and you'll down. But it was spoken this day. And we couldn't just continue to ignore it and put it in the back of our minds. And hearing it spoken out loud was honestly jarring. I didn't know how much I disagreed with that actual thought until I heard it verbalized. And this, along with a few other messages, began to spur conversations between Kat and I. And honestly, that's one thing I'm thankful for, is that we did happen to kind of grow together. You know, we could have just as easily diverged, and it would have been tough if one of us was still in that all-or-nothing system. And around this time, we started talking about going somewhere else, and I'm thankful Shereen and Zeke found this place and told us about the table. And I can remember one of the first messages we heard was Tim's message on hegemony. It talked about one of Jesus' parables about being the gate and the gatekeeper and how the Pharisees were not, and they were the thieves. And how the gate was wide open, and not just to a select few, but to everybody. Now, as I listened to Tim speak, I was shocked that the pastor, if I can call him that, was giving permission to leave the hedge, to question our faith, and saying things like it didn't necessarily matter that we all believe the same things. And I know Tim isn't the type to be prescriptive, and I don't want to be confused that he was giving us permission in some sort of authoritative way. It was the freeing permission, like, if you can't let yourself do this, maybe me saying it will give you that freedom. Now, this wasn't the first time I heard a sermon. Can I call Tim's messages a sermon? About doubt. I've heard many sermons about doubting Thomas. And they're always sort of the same framing. Something along the lines of, we're not perfect, you know, we're going to make mistakes, sometimes you doubt, but God is faithful, and if you keep trying hard enough, you'll eventually overcome your doubt, and your belief will endure, and probably be no different or unchanged on the other side. Tim's message was categorically not this. There wasn't a tidy answer you're going to come back to. Your belief might look completely different when you come out the other side. And I felt like Tim was talking directly to me. The other thing that got me was he was using scripture, but was talking about it in different ways. He was using the same book that for so long I said was one way, the truth, and using it to say something different. His message, both in content and in form, was exactly what I was feeling and thinking, but he gave it words, and in a sense, it was freeing. So again, as an actuary, I very much strive on a daily basis to solve problems and come out the other end with an answer that makes sense. That's what was nice about the old system. Had all the answers. But I couldn't ignore anymore that the answers weren't adding up. So even though it's very much against my personality, I'm getting more comfortable, or at least trying, with not having it all figured out. And somehow it makes more sense today than the certainty I had before. It feels a bit like a paradox in that my beliefs are more abstract, less concrete, yet somehow more real and alive. I feel so much more freedom to talk about and share my beliefs with others, and comfortable admitting that there's much I don't know and that I will never know. I'm okay with saying that my beliefs are just that, beliefs, not necessarily truths that everyone else should follow. One mantra, however you want to pronounce that, I'm trying to live with is don't hold on too tightly. You know, it's working for me now, but if it stops working for me, I can put it down again. This might sound fleeting, or it might sound like it doesn't matter, but I don't care. But it's not. It's just more of a lightness with what I believe. And I think it's probably safe to say that I actually care more. And I also don't want it to come across that I resent my past beliefs or my path. Sure, there are some things upon reflection I look back on with some embarrassment or even bewildering to think that I could have ever believed. But it's a path that brought me here. So I can't be completely all bad. And again, it's not like it was all bad or negative. I still have many positive memories. It was just too narrow of a belief system, and it was too exclusive, and it no longer reconciled to the world that I saw around me. Now, none of this is easy, and it's still very much my personality, and much more, I'd say, human nature, to want answers. And there's still that part of me, a voice from the previous system, that says, what if you're wrong? Even though I might tell myself I don't believe that anymore, it's still hard to shake that thinking. It's tough because for so long, to doubt was weakness, was bad, or a sin. And now I see that it's the opposite, that it takes strength to admit that you were wrong, or that you don't have it all figured out. And it's something, as a parent, this is something I'm trying to pass on to my children. You know, they ask some tough questions about God and spirituality, or just even anything for that matter, but I don't always have nice, tidy answers to give them. Answers that would have been more readily available in the previous system. And so we tell them we don't have it all figured out, and that's a mystery. And I'd rather pass along some uncertainty and some unknowing and give them confidence with that than to pass them a nice, tidy answer with all the unnecessary guilt that was present in that system. So in Pete Rollins' book, Idolatry of God, which I have here, he presents the idea that the modern church has served up God, or Jesus, as just another idol that will bring certainty and satisfaction. You know, we're bombarded with messages from society at large that if you would only just blank, you would be happy or complete. And you can fill that blank with whatever you want. A new job, a new car, house, money, girlfriend, boyfriend, taller, skinnier, whatever. But if you had that, you'd be full and complete. And in the book, he suggests that the church, instead of breaking that model of thinking altogether, puts God in place as just another one of those things. If only you had God, then you'd need it. So instead of transcending that system, it just becomes another idol or option on the shelf, another thing to tack onto the end of my list, something that provides the promise of certainty and satisfaction instead of attainment. So instead, he provides a different picture, which I'll read from you here. Page 145. To go through the event of crucifixion does not then mean that we are unified with what will make our lives complete, nor that we are given some secret knowledge that will abolish our ignorance, but that we can live without being complete and celebrate mystery instead of being afraid of it. He continues on a bit further down. As Christ dies on the cross, we read of the tombs breaking open and the dead coming to life. And a new mode of life erupts, a life in which the source of all is no longer approached as some being whom we ought to love, but as a mystery we can participate in through the very act of love itself. So he's describing a very different picture. So instead of trying to continue to push for that unattainable goal of certainty and completeness, to embrace the uncertainty, instead of seeing God as something that demands our love and has to be appeased, as something that is present in it all. I think this fits nicely with the image Judy gave us a couple weeks ago. Not seeing God as delivering us from pain and hardship, but as an ally that's present with us as we go through it. And again, this is not to suggest that we shouldn't attempt to strive for success or try to attain things. It's just shedding the belief that doing that will necessarily make you whole or complete. Another reference here I'll read for you. So, in Christ we are confronted with a different understanding altogether, one in which God is not directly known, but is the source that renders everything known. I listened to B.P. Rollins' books, or he has a podcast out there, and one thing he often talks about is this image of, you know, just picture yourself walking down a street. It's on any ordinary day. You probably ascribe very little meaning to walking down that street. But if all of a sudden a loved one comes around the corner, somebody you maybe haven't seen in 5, 10 years, somebody you care about, all of a sudden that day, that street is filled with meaning. When you're in love, when you're acting on love, or you're engaged in something, you don't have to look too far to find meaning. Another way I've heard this presented, which I really like and find helpful, is thinking of God as light. And not like moth as a flame, we're drawn to it, but God as light in that it illuminates everything that we do find meaning in. The interesting thing is when I look at the Bible now, I no longer see it as prescriptive, as a book of rules and certainty. It's filled with all sorts of stories of people who struggled with doubts and uncertainty, people working through their understanding of the divine and their place in the world. The Old Testament is story after story of the Israelites being oppressed and beaten down. David in Psalm 22 says, or more like cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from my cries of anguish. My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, I find no rest. So no, I don't see this book as a book of certainties, but as a collection of stories of humans attempting to work out their understanding of the world. So the question is, where does this leave me now? As we've been digging through our spiritual closets lately with Tim, I've been giving this a lot more thought. And when I tell people about my shift in thinking, about embracing more uncertainty, or maybe on a bad day, tolerating uncertainty, it might come across as though I have no beliefs left in the closet. But that's not really the case, so I wanted to share with you some of what I do believe now. This is not an exhaustive list, and in sharing this, I by no means I'm suggesting that this is what others should believe, but maybe there's something you can take from it. So number one, there is something more than we can taste, touch, hear, see, some force, something, some energy that connects us. Number two, I don't have it all figured out and gaining comfort with the fact I never will, but what I believe is working for me now. Three, what I believe will change and evolve. Four, no one person, group, or organization has cornered the market. I'd kind of mentioned this during one of our spiritual closet explorations with Tim, and I said something along the lines of, do what works for you. Now, this might sound flippant, but this isn't just to say that everything is good. It's just more of a rejection of the idea that everything that wasn't X is wrong. Everything that wasn't that one way is wrong. It's a rejection of that idea. Number five, it's less important what I believe and more important how I believe. My head could be filled with all sorts of great beliefs, but if they don't cause me to act in any particular way that's aligned with those beliefs, then what good are they? And on this note, I know that the here and now, this life matters. All too often that old system was concerned with the next life, and the only concern about this life was making sure that you got to that next one. It was less concerned about this current lived experience. And number six, there is no ultimate level of belief or success that will put in complete satisfaction. This might sound like a depressing thought, but I think it's the opposite. I think Judy touched on this again a couple weeks ago. We live in an imperfect world, and there will always be some sort of struggle, challenge, or maybe difficulty in your life. And as the excerpt I read from P. Rollins' book says, that maybe we can live without being complete and celebrate mystery instead of being afraid of it. So as I'm wrapping up here, ultimately I find this frees me from having to find meaning in what I believe, but instead believing that there is meaning, meaning to be found in my experience and moments shared with others. And one thing I'm trying to say lately is to see and find meaning in life and not necessarily the meaning of life. And again, that's what I love about the environment of the table and how Tim presents this in his messages. Never the final word, but usually the start of a conversation, an invitation to explore. Again, I hope that, you know, my short time with my words today, that was for you as well. Thank you.